Camel Guard versus Makura, Mr. Zaremski.
Good morning, Your Honors. Miles Zaremski, together with Mr. Myron Makoff, on behalf of Dr. Camel Guard. Your Honors, we reserve 5 minutes for a rebuttal. We have two motions that have been transferred to this panel for disposition, one filed on January 12th and one filed on July 23rd. The first was a motion to dismiss the cross appeal, and the second is a motion for sanctions, which we are standing on our pleading and will not present during oral argument.
What discovery did you complete before the case was dismissed?
We took one deposition of Dr. Kenneth Jones, or I did, in Shreveport, Louisiana, pursuant to Judge Collins' order that we had discovery rights against the American College of Surgeons. We completed that deposition, I believe it was on December 14th or December 13th, which was 1 or 2 days before Judge Collins entered her order on Dr. Makura's motion to dismiss the amended complaint. That has been the only discovery, Judge Rovner. Since the briefings have been completed, this court has come out with Brooks versus Ross, which Judge Flom has participated in, which sets forth the pleading requirements in light of Iqbal.
There's a big problem you have here. You can't move to dismiss for lack of venue and then argue the merits.
Well, we didn't move to dismiss.
The Bell and the Brooks case and Iqbal and all those cases. That's a matter of the merits. That's a 12B6 issue. That's not.
Well, I'm not focusing on those cases regarding 12B6, Judge Posner.
They have nothing to do with venue. You can't mix. Look, I think you've waived your objection to venue by getting into the merits.
Well, these cases.
The whole idea of a dismissal for lack of venue is that the court doesn't have to get into any issues having to do with the merits. It doesn't have to look at the adequacy of the pleading, whether there's a cause of action, or this or that. It's in the wrong court, go away.
Well, as soon as
the defendant starts saying, oh, well, no venue, but also no cause of action, then it's a waiver.
Judge Posner, Judge Collins, in her order of December 15th, said that the pleading itself was, quote, unquote, entirely speculative.
Yeah, but that's about the merits. That's 12B6. That's not venue.
Well, our opponent.
You've made a serious mistake. You've waived venue by getting into the merits. You're not allowed to do that.
Your Honor, our opposition moved to dismiss under 12B3 for venue purposes. We responded to that as we did, saying that venue was properly asserted in the Northern District of Illinois. So we are responding. If they were moving on venue, then they were getting into the fact that it either.
Wait, I don't understand. You're the defendant. I don't know.
We are the plaintiff, Your Honor. We are responding.
Have I gotten my signals crossed?
We are the appellant plaintiff.
Sorry.
Okay. Now, going back to the Brooks versus Ross case, Judge Flom was involved in that. Your Honor was involved in the Brown versus J.P. Morgan. And there's a third case, Hecker versus Deere, and this was all after we completed a briefing, but it focuses on the pleading requirements under Iqbal and under Twombly. And there are three requirements. One is notice to the defendant, sufficient to allow the defendant to respond. The second one is, are the allegations plausible? Now, that's a word in the dictionary. Justice Souter said in the Twombly case, it's got to be above the level of conceivability. And this court, in the three cases that I've cited, talk about, is there a reasonable inference that the allegations will lead to liability or lead to if the misconduct is shown? So we're using dictionary definitions. In our amended complaint that we filed on October 28th against Dr. Makura, we allege not all of the facts necessary to state a quote.
Okay, let me ask the right question. Now, I think your complaint is filed. This is what I think is your problem. I think I think your problem is that that New Jersey law should apply.
If in fact
New Jersey, that's where your client practices, right?
He practices there, Your Honor.
New Jersey. So that's presumably that's the place where he's going to be. That's where the injury from the defamation is going to occur. That is, if word gets back about McCura's letter and all that and so on, and these complaints against complaints with the American College of Surgeons and the Bariatric Association, that's where he'll be hurt. And so why isn't New Jersey the logical state to supply the rule of decision?
2 points, Judge Fulmer. One is that Dr. McCura said that Illinois law applied. Indeed, in Judge Collins' October 8th order, she stated specifically that the parties don't dispute that Illinois law applies. Now, thereafter...
Well, she expressed skepticism about that.
Well, I think she did express some skepticism, but nonetheless she articulated the fact that both parties, not only Dr. Kamelgar, but Dr. McCura, was saying that Illinois law applied. Thereafter, as in Lott versus Leavitt, the defendant switched gears. Now, to answer, Judge Posner, your question specifically as to why New Jersey is not the proper venue, if, in fact, there is a publication, the location of the publication, which is, for this purposes and undisputed, is Illinois.
It's also Florida.
If, in fact, then we are talking about multi-state defamation under Section 150 of the Restatement, there are two key requirements: that the publication must occur in the state of domicile of the aggrieved party. That does not take place in this case. Secondly, where injury is defined in terms of reputation, that's right in comment E to Section 150. Reputation transcends one state's borders, as if anyone in this courtroom or anybody on the bench were to be defamed in Portland, Oregon, and they sit in the state of Illinois, the reputation goes beyond Illinois. Just as Dr. Kamelgar, who's
why,
the...
Why, but how then would you choose between... between Illinois and Florida law?
Well, number one, the communication was sent to the American College of Surgeons in Chicago by Dr. McCura. That there was only one publication to the college that was in Illinois.
Yeah, but what about Florida?
It's true that Dr. McCura sent a publication to Florida, but if in fact there are multiple publications, in order for the multi-state doctrine under Rice versus Novo to apply, there's got to be publication in the domicile of the aggrieved party.
I don't understand. Suppose that that McCura had sent this letter to 49 states, every state except New Jersey. Then what state's law would apply?
Where the most significant contacts occur regarding...
What's so fuzzy, though?
Well, in this case, everything occurred in Illinois.
What about Florida?
There's nothing that occurred in Florida regarding a letter...
There was a publication in Florida, according to you. That means there was injury to reputation in Florida.
That was a different publication. That went to the Bariatric Society, not the American College of Surgeons.
Yes, I know. It was a different pub, but... But aren't you? But you're complaining about that letter,
Judge Posner. You're absolutely correct.
So you're complaining about an injury in Illinois and an injury in Florida.
If there was multiple publications, that means we have to analyze this under the doctrine of multi-state defamation.
No, look, you're repeating yourself. You have two injuries: one in Illinois, one in Florida. Now, and you say it can't be New Jersey. Illinois, I don't know why it can't be New Jersey. But how would you choose between Illinois and Florida?
Because there was no publication in Florida that went to the college. There's only one publication that this lawsuit is about.
You've lost me.
Pardon? Oh.
What do you mean there's only one public? You've complained about what happened in Florida also.
We say that there's a letter that was sent at the same time, same subject matter, by Dr. McCura regarding Dr. Kamelgard. Nothing occurred in Florida.
It's in your complaint.
We identify in our complaint the correspondence that went to Florida, but it's not action. We aren't.
I don't understand. You procure a letter of March 1st to the ASBS, contained false statements, which McCura knew were false, made with reckless disregard.
Your Honor, that was...
Delicious and this and that and the other.
You're using the letter in Florida to buttress what you view as your real complaint, which is the letter to the American College of Surgeons.
That is correct, Judge Rovner. I see my light is on. I wanted to save a few minutes for rebuttal.
But I don't understand. You mean this... When I read the complaint, I thought that you had two defamatory statements that you were trying to get a remedy for.
Judge Posner, we're using what occurred in Florida to buttress as foundation.
Can you point to some buttressing language in your complaint?
We identified by mere facts and in paragraphs within the facts section, and that's the best way to
For all the foregoing reasons, you're asking for judgment against McCura. The foregoing reasons include the defamation in Florida.
It's as to the defamation in Illinois.
Excuse me?
Our complaint is for the defamation that occurred in Chicago.
Where does it say that in the complaint?
Your Honor, I know my light's on. I wanted to save a few minutes for rebuttal, but I do want to answer your
question. So answer my question, would you please? You have as much time on rebuttal as you want. I will cut people off.
In our amended complaint, under count two is invasion of privacy, but count two.
Look at count one.
Pardon?
Look at count one.
Yes.
Count one on page 7 to 8 charges reputation in two documents.
But
the McCura letter to the ACS and the McCura letter to the ASBS.
But in the facts section, we put forward that the letter to the ASBS is what we knew to exist as a matter of fact. We had to plead on everything else on information and belief based upon the totality of the circumstances.
You're asking for damages for that letter to the ASBS,
as
you are for the rest of it.
No, we are not, Your Honor. I mean, respectfully, I would disagree.
There's nothing. You say for all the foregoing reason, you want this judgment. You want compensatory damages. And you've charged two letters as being malicious and intentionally malicious and unprivileged and amatory and so on and so forth. There's no indication that that's just buttressing. That's half your case, as far as anyone reading the complaint would think.
We would not have a cause of action in Illinois for something written in Florida because the tort occurs upon publication. The publication of the American College of Surgeons took place in Chicago.
Then why are you asking for damages for defamation for that letter to Florida?
Well, I don't believe we are, Your Honor. I mean,
Wherefore, for all the foregoing reasons, why did you even mention the letter to Florida if you don't want any relief?
Because we had to establish that was a letter in form and content that was just like the one we believe on information and belief that Dr. McCura sent to Chicago, also about Dr. Camelgard regarding the very same lawsuit in Brooklyn, New York, to which Dr. Camelgard testified.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Saper?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Adam Saper. I represent the appellee and cross-appellant, Dr. Jerzy McCura.
Can I just start you out this way? Here, there were two complaints filed within about 2 weeks of each other with two professional organizations for surgeons concerning the expert opinion, or rather testimony, I guess we'd say, by Dr. Camelgard in the same malpractice case in New York. Here's what we know. We know that Dr. McCarra authored one of those complaints. Could we really hold that it's not a plausible inference that he also authored the other complaint and that the allegations of wrongdoing were the same, especially given that he was the defendant in the New York case and Dr. Camelgar testified against him? Couldn't it be argued that it's even more likely than not that he was the author and that the complaints were the same? I mean, in other words, what are the odds that some other strange person sent a complaint at the same time concerning the same case to the American College of Surgeons?
Well, I don't know how to quantify that, Your Honor. If the author, the identity of the author is plausible, the content, we still know nothing of the content. If Dr. McCarra had...
Where's this letter?
Your Honor?
Where's this letter?
There's no evidence in the record relative to...
Well, where is the letter? Why isn't the letter in the record?
Because she didn't allow discovery, right?
No, she did allow...
Why don't we have the letter?
There was no production request.
They don't want the letter? They've never asked for the letter?
Correct.
Your opponent?
Correct. Your Honor, if the identity of the author is plausible, we still know nothing of the content. If Dr. McCarra had authored the second communication, he could have said as little or as much as he wished to say. It could have been a very different letter than the letter to ASBS. They are different organizations located different places, serving different roles, and we simply know nothing of the content of that communication.
It just seems to me that the inference is a plausible one, given that the timing of the two complaints was within a couple of weeks of each other. They involved the same malpractice case in New York, the same person, Dr. Camelgard. Dr. McCarra is the defendant in the New York case. Dr. Camelgard testified against him, thus giving Dr. McCarra a reason to want to retaliate against Dr. Camelgard, and we know that Dr. McCarra authored the ASBS complaint. I mean, it just seems that the allegations, it seems that there's enough for the allegations of the complaint to be plausible, meaning, you know, more than a sheer possibility, maybe less than probability. That's the standard here.
One of the difficulties, I think, Your Honor, with permitting this type of speculation is that there are a number of defenses to defamation that can be raised at the pleading stage. There's truth, there's innocent construction, there's privilege. There are other defenses. And I believe the reason that the majority of the district courts in this district have required or applied the pro hoc verba pleading requirement is that you need to know the exact words used in order to form your response of pleading and to raise these defenses. Here, we know nothing of the content. He literally is limited to knowing that it relates to the same general subject. It could just as soon be the case that that letter, if it was a letter, said, please be advised that I have sent a letter of complaint to the ASBS.
Well, we also have the statement in the order from the Circuit Court of Cook County that the defendant physician in the New York case lodged a complaint with the American College of Surgeons regarding Dr. Camelgard's expert testimony. So you've got, you know, a disclosure of the identity of the complainant by Judge Kagan, I think it was, who had reviewed the complaint.
The identity, perhaps, Your Honor? Yes. The identity, yes, Your Honor. The content, no. Again, all we know is it related to his testimony in that case. And so we simply have, the plaintiff here simply has no way to know what the content was. Maybe it was a short expression that was of pure opinion. I'm not in a position to raise that defense because they are purely speculating about the content of the communication. So ultimately, I think that the appeal calls upon the court to answer the question of whether a party is permitted to speculate about the content of the defamation, and basically, because there's a belief, because the animosity exists, that there should be some presumption that it was in fact false and defamatory.
Ask you a different question now. You originally thought that Illinois law would govern the case, right?
I originally argued Illinois law.
How long did it take you to switch to New Jersey law?
It was approximately 30 days. It was Judge Conlin's, very candidly, it was Judge Conlin's raising the question in her order that made me say, take a step back and say, wait a minute, why am I applying Illinois law? Which, candidly and somewhat embarrassingly, I argued because the parties had argued it.
Okay, well, that's fine. So, now, one of the things that's puzzling to me, the restatement does say that in a multi-state defamation case, you apply the law of the state of the plaintiff's domicile. If there was publication there, why is that required?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. May I have...
Why is publication required in the domicile of the plaintiff in a multi-state case? It's what the restatement says. It hurts your case, right? You don't have publication in New Jersey.
Well, that would be another contact in New Jersey, but the restatement follows the most significant contacts approach.
No, but it says, that... No, it does most significant conflict, but it says normally in a multi-state case there will be the law of the plaintiff's domicile will govern normally. But it says if there's publication there. Well, if there's no publication there, what then makes the domicile the most significant state in your view?
Well, I don't think that under the restatement or any of the cases interpreting it, although I've heard what you've just read, Your Honor, would require publication in the state of domicile in order for that rule to apply. I believe the rationale for the rule, and I hope I'm answering your question, is that in an ordinary case, and we would submit in this case, regardless of where it's published, the injury is going to be felt where one lives and works, such as a local doctor in this case. And so the publication, alleged publication in Illinois, is really the fortuity here. It is fortuitous and occurs only by virtue of the fact that the American College of Surgeons happens to be headquartered here.
But what could be worse for any physician's reputation than to be put to task by the finest and most important professional organization in his field or her field?
Well, in the abstract, I understand your point, but we have to look at, I mean, there are no allegations here nor any facts of record that would suggest that that any damage other than some presumed damage based on a defamation per se occurred here. There's no relationship alleged between Dr. Camelgard and anyone in Chicago. So if, assuming arguendo, that Dr. Collicott, for example, that his view of Dr. Camelgard was somehow lowered as a result of any of this, so what?
Oh, my goodness. So
what?
Oh,
from
you don't
a
mean
standpoint,
so what? I hope you don't mean
well,
so.
Well, I don't mean to make light of it, Your Honor.
You have two types of injury in a defamation case. You have an injury to reputation for which you can get general damages, and then you have a tangible injury to your income and so forth. So what your opponent is arguing, what Judge Rovner was alluding to, is that you can have a reputation injury for which you could get general damages and yet have no provable, financial loss.
I understand, and I do acknowledge that, but let's look at the weight, the great weight, of where the damage would occur. If Dr. Collicott had a lesser view, I certainly don't mean to make light of that. This gentleman was a medical doctor. That is one circumstance. But the great weight is the alleged loss of reputation, alleged loss of professional reputation.
That's true, but when you think about what law applies, you don't look just at injury. You look also at, you know, the witnesses and the this's and the that's. And if he's really just concerned about the Illinois publication, then you're going to have witnesses in Illinois, you know, American College of Surgeons people and their investigatory machinery and all that. By the way, is it your understanding also that CamelGuard is only seeking damages for what may have occurred in Illinois, that he's not interested in the Florida stuff?
Absolutely not. I have never heard that before. There is nothing in the record. The first time I heard this was today. There is nothing in the record to suggest this. I have always understood this to be, based upon the record, a case about two alleged communications, one to ASBS in Florida and one to ACS in Chicago. It may well be, and I think it is, that they are also attempting to support their information and belief allegations relative to the ACS communications.
Right.
Yes. But I've always understood it to be a claim seeking to recover damages for both of those. And every element of the cause of action is alleged with respect to both communications. If it was simply meant to buttress, you just put it in your facts section. But it's both places. It's in the general allegations, and then it's also in each count. And I don't know how any conclusion other than this is a claim based upon both communications could be reached based upon this record.
One more question, which is that how can you really waive the venue thing? I mean, haven't we moved on from venue? Because you're arguing the merits. You're saying New Jersey law applies and it bars the suit. Right? That's the merits. So isn't it a little late to be arguing about venue?
The district court dismissed.
Wouldn't it be strange? Suppose we disagreed with you about the New Jersey law. Would we then be writing an opinion which said, yeah, there's no venue in Chicago, but incidentally, we don't think New Jersey law applies? I mean, wouldn't that be. That would be the merits. That wouldn't be venue.
Well, I viewed the universe of possibilities.
You want dismissal with prejudice, and that's not a venue dismissal either. You want dismissal with prejudice because you want us to decide the merits, which is fine. You can do that, but I don't see how we can decide the merits and dismiss for want of venue.
Well, it surely was, Your Honor can well imagine, not my intent to waive the venue issue. The venue issue is what resulted in the dismissal. We believe it to be correct. We cross-appealed because we didn't receive all that we requested. And a more complete order, a more favorable order to Dr. McCura, would have reached the other issue that we raised, which would have, if we prevailed, resulted in a dismissal with prejudice. So the tenor of our arguments before this court really was that if the court didn't agree that venue was improper, that there was another basis to reach a dismissal, in fact, with prejudice.
Okay, well, fine. Thank you, Mr. Safer.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Zaremski, something further I know?
Thank you, Your Honors.
Why did you drop your request for the letter to the ACS? It seems basic to your
case. We never did.
Especially when you argue that this Florida letter is just buttressing. I think it's totally untenable, but that's your argument.
Mr. Posner, we never dropped.
Why didn't you get the letter?
We never dropped our request for the letter from the American College of
Surgeons. You withdrew it in front of Magistrate Denlow.
We never dropped our request. We were never allowed to discovery.
You withdrew your motion for third-party discovery.
We were, with regards to the discovery, Judge Posner, Judge Conlon said that we were entitled to discovery. We then went before we asked what it was because we couldn't find it under the federal rules. We were told that's improper. So we filed a motion to undertake discovery. That motion was transferred to Judge Denlow. Judge Denlow, during oral arguments with Mr. Makoff and me, said, why don't you go ahead pursuant to Federal Civil Procedure 45 with depositions? So we issued a subpoena for deposition the following day on Dr. Jones in Shreveport, Louisiana. And that's where we started. After we got the transcript back, a day later, Judge Conlon ruled on Dr. Mercura's motion. I wanted to wrap up by saying...
You've completely lost me. You need the letter was sent to the American College of Surgeons, right?
I asked for it multiple times. Dr. Camelgard asked for it, and they refused.
Well, so why didn't you institute proceedings to get hold of the letter?
Because the American College of Surgeons was dismissed without prejudice.
You can have third-party discovery. You don't have to.
What we did is we filed a motion. It was transferred to Judge Denlow. I'm repeating myself. I'm sorry. And we went through deposition. It was really quite quickly that we were moving as quickly as we can.
I don't understand. Why didn't you... Why didn't you seek a subpoena the American College of Surgeons for the document that you need?
For the discovery, we were at issue regarding a pleading. They filed a motion to dismiss. It was briefed, and then Judge Conlon ruled as she did. Thereafter, we went ahead within a couple of days to go back in. It's in the appellate court record, so we were not dilatory, Judge Posner.
What you're saying? What's this business about Shreveport?
Shreveport was where Dr. Kenneth Jones was located.
Who's he?
He is a physician who had information that leaked out of the American College of Surgeons.
Can't you get a judge to sign a subpoena to the American College of Surgeons saying you want a copy of this letter for a lawsuit? I mean, can't you do that?
Well, once we're in discovery, but discovery was not allowed, or at least paper discovery.
What do you mean not allowed? Magistrate Judge Denlow didn't allow you to ask for a subpoena?
Judge Denlow, and it's in the transcript, which is part of this appeal when we were before him, suggested that we go the route of Rule 45. We followed His Honor's suggestion and the following day issued a subpoena for deposition issued by the Western District of Louisiana upon Dr. Kenneth Jones, who lives in Shreveport. I went down there and took a deposition.
Why go through depositions rather than sending a subpoena to the American College of Surgeons? That's where the letter is.
That's correct. Well, Dr. Mercura has to have the letter, too. He authored it.
He could have sent it and not have a copy. If you want the letter, it was actually received, which might be different from the letter that Mercura has in his possession. So why don't you just... Is there some legal obstacle to subpoenaing a letter from the American College of Surgeons?
Dr. Camelgard and I, requested it on four different occasions. It was refused. So if we issued...
I'm not talking about a request. I'm talking about a subpoena. Magistrate Judge Denlow to issue a subpoena to the ACS?
If we requested a subpoena, it would have been disputed, and we would have been briefing that as well, and passed the date for...
That's all wrong.
If I might make one...
That's all wrong. It's ridiculous for us to have this case without the letter. That's just ridiculous.
Your Honor, the letter is being hidden. I understand
and
that.
It gets you into all this absurdity about how you have this thing in Florida because you have a letter, and maybe it's the same as the letter to the American College of Surgeons, and that's why you mentioned Florida, but you don't want damages. It's also screwed up.
Well, it's being hidden, and I think
being hidden. You haven't gone through the normal route of obtaining a document that's, vital in litigation.
If we reach...
Magistrate Judge Denlow tells you to go to Shreveport, which is ridiculous, because the letter is not in Shreveport. Then you go back to Judge Conlon, and you say, I need that letter from the American College of Surgeons, and I want a subpoena.
The way that was postured, Judge Posner, was that we pled on information and belief, which has to be taken as true.
It's ridiculous, because there's a letter sitting in the files, and it's either defamatory or it's not defamatory. It's either like the letter to Florida or it's not like that letter. And once you have the letter, one can proceed in an intelligent fashion in the case. But to come up to the appellate court without the essential bit of evidence in the record, what sense does that make?
Judge Posner,
does it make sense?
Typically it would not make sense, but we did not and were not given the opportunity.
Well, let me ask you about
yes,
that.
Yes, Judge Posner.
Maybe I'm not tracking this. You're before Magistrate Denlow. You suggest to us that he suggested to you take a deposition. Now, yes. Included in that suggestion, are you telling us that he excluded the possibility of document production?
I can't track
your being before a United States magistrate asking for discovery. You say he suggested, I haven't read the transcript, that you go to Louisiana. I appreciate that. You want to take that deposition, that's fine. But that seems to me to be more a substantial move than just seeking a document production of a document, I assume, housed in Chicago.
Judge Flom, after Judge to answer your question, I have to backtrack up just a moment. After Judge Conlon issued an order dismissing the complaint against the American College of Surgeons without prejudice, but, and I'm paraphrasing, plaintiffs have discovery rights against the college. I'm paraphrasing that. Well, both Mr. Makoff and I scoured the rules, and we couldn't figure out the discovery that the court was referring to, so we filed a motion with Judge Conlon, and Judge Conlon said, you're asking for, and I'm paraphrasing, an advisory opinion, and that's impermissible. I don't think she ever ruled on it.
Had you been before Judge Denlow at this point?
No, we had not. We then filed a motion for discovery that Judge Conlon, before Judge Conlon, Judge Conlon then transferred the motion to Judge Denlow.
Right.
Then his honor scheduled a hearing on it. We then went before him and, you know, to force some discovery, and he said, well, I think what you really are asking me is for Rule 45 discovery. And I'm paraphrasing, Your Honors.
Did he say he couldn't order ACS to produce the letter?
Your Honor, I don't believe that became an issue, if I recall the transcript and the colloquy.
Why
that went.
Why didn't you tell him you want the letter?
Well, I believe that it probably came up, but that was the, and again, I'm recalling from memory, but that was tracking, he tracked us on Rule 45.
Why are we not on parallel tracks? I appreciate you wanting to go to Louisiana, but why not go up the street and get the letter? I mean, we're 2 miles from the letter, and you're going to go 1,200 miles to take a deposition. I'm not suggesting that's inappropriate, but I don't understand in that same discourse about discovery, why not go to what seems to be a central document?
Well, at that point, the American College of Surgeons was not in the case. It was
I understand.
And therefore, all we had was, you know, the letter from Florida and the letter in Illinois they wouldn't give to us. So while I suppose we could attempt to get leave to issue a subpoena on the college now as a third party rather than as a party defendant, we knew that would be disputed because they just won't give it up. And they wouldn't. And there was nothing, it's almost like hiding the letter that everyone knows about except Dr. Camelgard.
The way to confront that, I guess, is to bring it before an independent magistrate, right? I mean, the issue that they won't produce it.
At the time that we were before Judge Denlow, there was only one defendant, and that was Dr. McCura. And the motion was to get some discovery relating to both McCura and the college, and that so we just start, you know, with one deposition and try to go slowly.
Rule 45 is not about depositions. Rule 45 is about subpoenas.
That's correct.
You said that Judge Denlow said, oh, you're here under Rule 45, so you must want a deposition.
I believe he suggested the Rule 45 route. which is subpoenas.
Rule 45 root is not depositions. It's subpoenas. That's all there is in Rule 45.
Right.
I mean, correct.
No. I'm saying that Rule 45 has to do with issuing subpoenas.
How do depositions get into it?
Because we wanted leave to take a deposition to confirm allegations against the college.
Why don't you just send a subpoena to the college? That's what a subpoena is for, to get a document.
Well, I'm...
Command to produce documents. Did you ask for a subpoena?
I don't understand.
You say you did research and you couldn't discover anything in the federal rules,
yes.
Which you'd never heard of a subpoena?
No. Judge Posner, in Judge Collins' order, when she dismissed the college without prejudice, she said, and I'm paraphrasing again, not quoting, that we had discovery rights.
But that includes a subpoena, Rule 45.
So we then filed a motion before Her Honor. She transferred to Judge Denlow, and Judge Denlow said, well, if you want to issue a subpoena, you can do so, and I'll give you leave to do so. So we prepared a subpoena for deposition on Dr. Jones to develop the case.
Subpoena for a deposition? Subpoena for a document. You want a document. What do you want a deposition for?
In order to establish that the defamation that arose out of the college had spread beyond, it was supposed to be confidential. We knew that Dr. Jones.
That's a completely separate issue. This is one of the most confusing things I've ever heard in my life. I understand how you want to go to Shreveport to find that the poison has spread. That's fine. That's completely unrelated to getting hold of a copy of the defamatory letter itself.
Well,
so you know what it says. For that, you subpoena the document. The letter, you don't subpoena Dr. Jones in Shreveport.
But we were not, Judge Posner, we were not at the stage in the underlying case to enter into discovery.
No, the document is the stage number one in the underlying case. I mean, you're going out and you're going to see whether there was defamation, a defamatory something repeated in Shreveport based on a letter that's in Chicago, and you've made no effort to get the letter.
Well, not part of the legal process.
You never subpoenaed the letter.
But not part of the legal process. We did make efforts to obtain the letter. We asked for it, and it was refused.
So then you issue a subpoena.
Okay. We did not issue a subpoena for the letter at any time because of the way the case was postured. If I might make one more point, and I know I'm way over. With respect to the injury element, Judge Rovner, I believe, said that properly, but in our reply brief, we quote Section E, Comment E to Section 150 of the Restatement. And it talks about, about publishing in the state of domicile.
What page are you on?
It would be page 6, Judge Flom. First kind of full paragraph, it says Comment E to Section 150 states, and if you drop down to the last bolded section that we bolded, if there was publication in the state of plaintiff's domicile, and if the plaintiff is known only in this state, and consequently his reputation, and that's the point I'm trying to make here, they use the word reputation, not economic loss to one's practice, if his reputation only suffered injury there. So we're really talking about reputation that trans...
Where does he have a reputation beyond New Jersey? Does he have a reputation beyond New Jersey?
Oh, sure.
In the sense... of just membership in national organizations?
He's a fellow of the
American... So if you're a member of the National Rifle Association, you have a reputation in all of the 50 states?
Well, I guess reputation has to be measured, but if you're a member, a fellow, active in an organization...
Every lawyer in the American Bar Association has a reputation throughout the country?
That's a matter of degree, a matter of proof.
We're talking degree here.
Right.
So,
I would say that if you're a member of a national organization and you're participating outside your home state, you're going to have a reputation with your
one
college.
Convention, two are conventions. What do we look to as far as a substantial? I mean, there are physicians and attorneys who have obviously multi-state practices. Do we have that here?
With Dr. Joseph Campbell, yes. Have we measured it? Have we, you know, he's been to 10 meetings. No, we have not done that. But that would come out as a matter of proof. He's a fellow. I mean, the contacts within the state of Illinois, I mean, he's a fellow. He applied there. He was investigated here. The charge letter came from Illinois. I mean, I could go through it, and it's in pages 9 and 10 of our reply brief. I don't need to take the court's time, but the contacts are ad nauseum with respect to Chicago and the state of Illinois.
Would you say his reputation was injured in what venue in its greatest fashion? Where is the doctor today, in your view, suffered his greatest reputation?
Illinois is at the top. You know, if you want to put his home state or where he's from, New Jersey, Florida, there was nothing actionable by the Bariatric Society down there. But
people talked about it in California, too, right?
Pardon?
Didn't you have a California contact here, too? Didn't he learn of the defamation, alleged defamation in Illinois from a colleague?
Dr.
At a colleague in California at a national conference?
It was Dr. Jones, who's from Shreveport, as we mentioned, but he met Dr. Jones in San Diego at a professional meeting.
So was the reputation injured then in California?
That we don't know, other than, well, Dr. Jones is from Louisiana. I will tell you, Judge Flom, that the bariatric surgeons among the population of surgeons, it's kind of a small country club, quote unquote, kind of everybody knows one another. There's not that many, you know. So, in fact, you know, if he found out from Dr. Jones, who's from Louisiana, attending a San Diego, California professional meeting, there would be others that would know it. In fact, when we took Dr. Jones' deposition, there are indeed others. We just didn't get to that point in the deposition. So the answer is yes. So reputation transcends one's domicile.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Zaramski.
And colleagues, members of the court, thank you.
We'll move on to the next.